Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to a great Friday night we have here in store for you on Suspense Radio Live. I'm telling you, I am electric about this show, feeling really good. We have best-selling authors Margaret Weiss and Chris Kuzneski on the phone, and it is going to be a great show. We also here flying a little solo, so as far as the SmackDown goes tonight, it's probably going to be pretty easy to SmackDown with one. So I'm not going to have a SmackDown segment tonight, but I'm going to have great book reviews, a lot of information, a lot of news coming up. So I want everyone to sit back. I want you to relax because we're going to turn it up tonight because 60 minutes of Suspense Radio starts now. I don't know if I need to turn the heat up anymore here in Southern California because it has been extremely hot over the past week, but I'm telling you, the show's going to be electric tonight, and it's going to be turning up the heat. So I'm your host, John Robb. Like I said, I am flying a little solo tonight. Don't have my normal co-host with me, Matt McElreath, but I want to remind everybody here that we're going to bring Margaret on, Margaret Weiss, best-selling author. She's going to be on in about 7 minutes. The phone number for you guys to call in here, if you have any questions, we get the chat room, which is always electric and always explosive that we have. The phone number is 877-666-9320. The chat room is always open. You can tune right in here, type your questions up. A lot of good things we got going on here with Suspense Magazine. We got our distributor going out with everything that we have. Our September issue is going to be here on Tuesday. That's going to be distributed out to everybody with some fabulous information. It's our debut author month, and we have some great authors that you guys need to definitely check out in there, along with D.P. Lyle and Shane Yerke on extensive interviews that we've had, because we've had them both on the show, but they get a little deeper into what they have been doing, what they are going to do. So you definitely want to check out the September issue of Suspense Magazine. If you haven't been a friend of ours on Facebook, what we've decided to start doing is we're giving the readers the option to pick the cover of the magazine. So we've just posted here on Facebook, and you can find us at Suspense Magazine. Friend us out. Check out our fan page, because we have the 5 cover options posted out there right now for you to get on, vote which one's your favorite, and the winner is what's going to be up for the October issue that we have, which is dedicated to horror. So I'm just telling you now, some of the covers might be a little on the queasy side, but they're all extremely good from this author. We're just so happy that we found him. The other thing here is Scott Nicholson, one of our contributors that writes all the time for our magazine every month, is doing something very interesting. He can be found at hauntedcomputer.com, and he's doing a 90-day blog tour where he's going out and he's extremely into the indie authors and extremely into what's going out there on the different sides of publishing, maybe away from some of the traditional sides, on better how to, you know, get your book out, whether it's through self-publishing or ebook publishing or anything else like that, because he's just doing a great job. So check out HauntedComputer.com. He's giving away a free Kindle. He's got a lot of great information out there for you guys to look at. So that's Scott Nicholson, who's also written numerous books. All of them are fantastic, and you have to check those out. So I'm going to go on here to my book review segment, and I got 3 books tonight. The first one is a medical thriller by probably one of the top medical thriller writers out there, in Michael Palmer. And this book just came out this year, and it's called The Last Surgeon. Michael Palmer is one of those authors that, whether you like medical thrillers or just not really picked one up, he's the perfect one to, I guess, start with and get your feet wet. This book has been out for a while. It came out on February 16th, and Michael is probably, I would say, you know, right up there. When you speak of medical thrillers, people think of, you know, maybe Robin Cook, but Michael has published 12 novels here. We met him at Thriller Fest. We heard him talk a little bit, and it's just fascinating. So definitely want to go out and pick up The Last Surgeon here by Michael Palmer, because it is definitely another winner. The other two I have are, one of them here is by a lesser known author, and it is kind of along the lines of, it's fantasy suspense, which is great because that's what we have, you know, Margaret on the line here, going to come up soon for her interview. And this is called Dante's Journey by J.C. Marino. And he sent us a nice letter, got this book. We said, you know what, send this over to us here. He can be found at the Novel Guy on the internet. And it's Dante's Journey by J.C. Marino. And this is one of those books that kind of takes you back in time a little bit with some of the writing style. And he does a great job at putting together a mystery or a fantasy suspense book that is definitely one to go check out. The last one I have is by Paul Cleave, and it is called Blood Men. And this came out here in July. And Tess Gerritsen, one of the, and John Colley, two fabulous authors, have written stellar reviews on this book by Paul Cleave. It's a thriller. He's an international best-selling author, and he's one of those, you know, even though he's a best-selling author, he's probably still one of those names in America, I don't think, that is at the fingertips or on the lips of everybody. And he came out here with Blood Men, just absolutely just killing it here with this thriller book. So this is definitely another one you want to pick up. So this is Blood Men by Paul Cleave. So those are the three that I have for you tonight, and I just want to go and say that, again, our call-in number is 877-666-9320. Our last show that we had on Tuesday was with D.P. Lyle and Brendan Novak, and if you guys didn't catch that show, it is one that you want to go back and see, because you have D.P. Lyle, who is one of those authors who's a consultant on many different shows of like Law & Order, CSI, NCSI, The Glades. He's a cardiologist. He'll tell other authors and tell other TV shows exactly, well, how do you kill somebody and what's going to happen when you do it? He wrote Forensics for Dummies. His book came out, Stress Fracture. And so he was absolutely fascinating. Brenda Novak is another one that has just written this Hired Gun series, Department 6 Hired Gun series. And her latest book comes out on August 31st with Body Heat, and then she has another one coming out, I believe it's called Killer Heat, here in September. So she did the July, August, September one, and this book came out in a series, like I said, the Hired Gun series. So Brenda Novak and D.P. Lyle, you can listen to all the replayed shows here on Blog Talk Radio or by going to suspensemagazine.com/suspenseradio or just follow the link on the homepage. Because now that we're picked up by Netflix through the Roku, we're on iTunes for podcasting. You know, we're on 75 other podcasting sites because we just have outstanding guests every week coming here to you guys live. Excuse me. And speaking of outstanding guests, the author that I'm going to bring on here now is an absolutely international best-selling author of the Dragonlance series, probably one of the most well-known fantasy suspense series that's ever been written, without a doubt. And it's just great to be able to have Margaret Weiss with us tonight. So, Margaret, how are you doing? Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm great.
Well, we were talking a little off air because I want to get into, you know, your works and your books. But the thing that I find fascinating is that you have a production company. And what you've been doing is you now have role-playing games for TV shows. With your latest was Smallville, and you've done Leverage and Supernatural. So what made you decide to go ahead and get into that realm of production with doing that?
Actually, back in the day when we were Sovereign Press, we did the Dragonlance role-playing game, which we licensed from Wizards of the Coast. And we had really good success with that. And my entire company was in love with the television show Firefly. And when the Serenity movie came out, we just thought, well, you know, what the heck? Let's see if we can go to Universal and get the license for Serenity. And we did, much to our astonishment, and that was a huge success for us. And it was so much fun. We got invited to the movie premiere. It was an awesome time. And so from there, we just kept on. We just keep doing shows we like.
Now, just, and everybody, you can go to margaretweiss.com and you can find out a lot more and shop online and buy the games and find out a lot more about what's going on. But now, how do you pick exactly which show you want to do to have out here in the production?
Well, what we try to do, we take a look at our audience role-playing gamers are interested in these days, and we try to pick shows to match that. Leverage was actually kind of a surprise. We did, our game system is called the Cortex system, and we kept getting letters and emails from people who said, you know, I'm using your system to role play Leverage, the TV show, and it's really working great. And so that was a case where the fans actually came to us, and then we discovered that the guy who developed Leverage is a huge role-playing gamer.
That's always nice, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So unlike, you know, some people, like when we went to Universal, they had no clue what a role-playing game was. The Leverage people knew all about it. So that was really neat.
Well, and just so you can kind of tell everybody exactly what the game is and how they can do it, can you just explain a little bit about, like if they were to pick up Leverage, you know, what can they expect from that?
Well, if you pick up Leverage, you could you just sit around the table with a bunch of your friends, and somebody, the GM, the game master, leads you through the game. And you can be Parker, you can be Elliot, you can be or you can be totally your own con artist if you want to be. And you have a scenario, you have that you play through in which you're going to try to help somebody, and you just kind of go from there. It all takes place in your imagination. You get to roll some funny looking dice, and that's about it.
So, and the replay value, of course, is just, you know, you can just keep doing it and doing it because you just never know where it's going to go, which is, you know, kind of the fascination back in, you know, when I was growing up. I mean, it was, you know, Dungeons and Dragons was the big role-playing game, and, you know,
right,
you could kind of take yourself the same way that people take themselves into books, is you take yourself into a whole nother world of, you know, of getting out. And I think that's, you know, and that's fascinating to see that you're doing something like that because it is so new and, you know, refreshing.
Oh, well, thank you. We have fun.
Yeah, and now, time to go back a little bit for, you know, people who might not have read the Dragonlance series, because, you know, this is a fantasy suspense. I guess you want to say Dragonlance. How would you define Dragonlance to someone to say, okay, well, what exactly is Dragonlance? Because it's not just the names of the books. I would guess, because I've read many of them. It's more along the lines of, it's a world, is the Dragonlance
right
world. And
it's a shared world. Tracy and I, Tracy Hickman, my co-author, and I wrote the first six novels, and we've written other novels since, but those were the six that really started everything. And basically, it's a world where men and women ride on the backs of dragons, and there's a war going on between good and evil. And we have some heroes that are trying to defeat the bad guys. There's elves and dragons, of course, and just all sorts of fascinating characters, cyclops, draconians, it's Kender. Everybody loves Kender.
Right.
So it's just, it's kind of, that's, you know, it sounds kind of like your typical fantasy world, but it's been very special to us and to a lot of people.
And a lot of authors, you know, always write about what they know. Like if you're a doctor, you're writing a medical thriller, or if you're a lawyer, you're writing a legal thriller. But you claim to have not read fantasy books, but writing for fantasy. How did that come about? Was that very difficult to merge yourself into that?
Well, I read Tolkien back in the 60s when I was in college when Tolkien came out in the 60s, and it swept across the United States, especially the college campuses, and I just loved it. And then after Tolkien, there wasn't a lot of other fantasy out there. I majored in writing in college, and I just kind of wrote what I was interested in and worked for about 10 years, kept my day job for about 10 years, and then went to work for TSR, which is really how I was introduced into fantasy, the Dungeons & Dragons type fantasy.
So that kind of helped, you know, get yourself in your mind kind of in the world of doing that. And now there's a chat room question on here, because this is off the subject of fantasy, but you wrote a children's book about Jesse and Frank James, and they want to know if it's still in print and if it's actually used in schools.
I don't believe it's in print any longer. I think it was actually used in the Missouri schools many, many years ago. But that book, I think, came out in 80 or 81. So it was all I really loved. I really enjoyed writing that book.
So Jesse, the James and the Unger Gang was one of your, like, growing up, that was, like, one of the things that you like to research and write about and read about.
Yeah, because my mother had a friend who knew where Frank James was buried in Independence, Missouri, and Frank did not want his name on his headstone because he was terrified of grave robbers. Because the rumor was that, you know, the James brothers would bury their money, you know, and that he was afraid people would dig up his grave to find the money. So I knew where Frank James was buried, and that was such a cool thing for me, just to go look at his grave and think of my, you know, it gave me a real connection to history. And so that kind of led me into the research into Quantrill and the whole bloody Missouri-Kansas warfare, and just kind of went from there.
Wow. I mean, now, I take it now, of course, that now with all the internet and everything that's going out, has that gravesite been a little bit more public knowledge now, or is it still very secretive?
I don't know. It was a family secret, so I'm not sure if there are, you know, and it was in kind of a forgotten area, a part of town, so I'm not sure if people know about it or not.
Well, just in case anyone's asked, I don't know where it's at, so, you know, don't come after me. I've been to Missouri, and I went to and I can't remember the name of the cave where they used to hang out a lot, and they used to hide out, and I always thought that was really fascinating, because I always loved those mysteries, kind of like Billy the Kid and Jesse James. Were they really killed the way that they said they were, or did they get out and, you know, live a longer life in secrecy? And I always thought that was extremely interesting.
Well, I can tell you one thing, that the Jameses didn't hide in caves.
Oh, really? So they lied to us on the tour.
It was part of the myth that developed around Jesse. Actually, they made money enough, they generally stayed in hotels.
Ah, so the tour guide lied to us in the cave. That's why they charged an extra $15 to get in there, because you thought you were going to go where Jesse James stayed. Now I know how they do it.
That was just part of the mythology that grew up around the James brothers.
Now, going back again, there's another chat room question here. Someone wants to know, you wrote an adventure book that was written at a second grade level, but it was intended for prisoners. Now, what was the title, and how did that happen to come about?
That was the time that I was writing, just to, you know, to keep my agent happy. I was writing any sort of book that anybody brought to me. So a publisher came to my agent and said, we need some authors who can write adult-type books on a juvenile level, or books with plots that would appeal to adults, and on a first to second grade reading level, because it was for a literacy program. and I cannot remember the name of it, but it was it had to do with World War II. I found a prisoner escape story, I think it was, in World War II, and so I wrote that book, which was very difficult writing that and on a second grade reading level.
Right, that would be kind of difficult to try to bring yourself down to have to do that. So
yeah, it helps with the discipline.
That's for sure. That's true. So why don't you tell everybody a little, like, you know, what are you doing now? Because I know that there's another series coming out, Dragonlance Wise. Can you kind of give everybody an idea of, like, what you're doing right now?
Well, I'm not doing any more Dragonlance because Wizards of the Coast is no longer publishing Dragonlance. So.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Yeah. So, but what I'm doing now is I've just finished, my co-author, Robert Kramus, and I have just finished a new series called Dragon Brigade. And I'm really excited about this series because it's really different from anything I've ever done in fantasy. I mean, there's guns, there's pistols, there's cannons, dragons, saints, demons. It's really, really neat. Very exciting.
So it's off a little bit of what you had written in the past. So you're kind of bringing a little bit of difference into it.
Yep, absolutely. It's more set in like maybe 1800s would be equivalent, although it's a different world. It's a world of floating continents where people travel the world on in carriages with hot air balloons pulled by wyverns and men ride on the back of griffins. And of course there is the Dragon Brigade. It's just a really fun series. I think people are really going to enjoy it.
And how many books are going to be included with this series? Or do you even know yet?
We have three planned. So hopefully that's how many there will be, and maybe more. You never know. Depends on if it takes off.
Now, do you have the names for all three of them?
The first one is called The Shadow Raiders, Dragon Brigade, The Shadow Raiders. And we don't have names for the other two yet.
Okay, but they're going to
come. We do know the
plot. Now, is the second one, excuse me, is that going to come out in 2011?
The first one comes out in May of 2011, The Shadow Raiders. That comes out in 2011.
Okay, so, and then you're probably like a year after before the other two, so...
In the meantime, I'm working on the third book in the Dragon Ship series that I'm doing with my other co-author, Tracy Hickman. So
you've got a lot going on.
Yes.
And I read something, and I'm trying to find it again because I was looking at this before, but there's something with the cover of one of these books that made you shocked.
That must have been the Wizards, the last Dragonlance book from Wizards of the Coast.
I believe, yeah, you wrote something saying that it was shocked because it was different from what you had thought it was going to be.
Yes, I mean, basically they just did a hatchet job on it. Because they're taking away all like the Dragonlance logo and replacing it with the Dungeons and Dragons logo, and they did that at the top and dropped the artwork down and chopped it in half.
And
so the artwork you're seeing on the Dragonlance Chronicles omnibus has been cut in half, and they chopped it off right underneath the chin of the main character. It's really ludicrous, and it's just, I was just so angry. I am still angry whenever I think about it. And they they sent me the mock-up of the book, and it looked beautiful, you know, and then they completely butchered it.
So now how much, so it sounds like, you know, as an author, do you, you know, how much say do you have in, you know, what you want your books to look like?
Well, most publishers are really, really good about giving authors approval on the art, or at least asking our opinion and showing us the art. And in fact, the Dragon Ships book, we're working with artist Tom Kidd. And my editor has sent, I mean, he reads the entire book before he does the painting to get a feel for the book, which is just absolutely incredible. And I've already been in contact with him. And, you know, so this is an excellent working relationship between an artist and an author. And in this case, that didn't happen.
Wow. I mean, that had to be a shocking, because a lot of people I don't think realize, you know, that you have how much, I guess, little control maybe you do have of your own, you know, work that you have out there. And, you know, for someone like you that's written, I mean, gosh, dozens and dozens of books, you would think you made it to a point where they would trust you over than just, you know, changing for whatever they, you know, wanted to do. So
well,
that's probably
the thing is,
the part.
You know, I mean, you have to draw, having been an editor myself, I kind of know both sides of the story, and having worked at TSR and worked with some of the artists, it's like Larry Elmore says, sometimes you get authors who want you to paint an entire city scene being, you know, with 35,000 dwarves and 6 dragons overhead and, you know.
Right.
So there does have to be kind of a mediating factor.
Now, there's another question here. We've got a lot of fans that are just blowing up the chat question here, and I'm trying to go through them to see, you know. But someone wants to know, and I thought it was maybe a little interesting, if you could only write one more book, would you? What do you think? What kind of genre would it be? Would it be more, you know, a children's book? Would it be more, you know, an adult book? What would you go for?
Ooh, I think I'd write the second Dragon Brigade book.
The second, and then tell the other one. Okay, that's it. now, a lot of times, you know, there's special sites set up for. You know, the series of, you know, like Dragons of Autumn, Twilight, and those series, and Raceland and things. What is the best site for people to go to find out more about Dragon Brigade and the Dragon Ship books that you're writing about?
Let's see. Well, Margaret Weiss Productions mainly right now is dealing with, you know, our product, our Smallville and Leverett and things like that. But we are going to be expanding that site to include the books, especially when we get closer to publication date. Like for Dragon Brigade, we've got some real special things planned that, and you can always become my friend on Facebook.
Right.
Because I talk about, you get to hear a lot about my dogs and flyball racing, but occasionally I do talk about the books. just those places would be good.
And so speaking now of your, and going back to your production, what's the one TV show that has eluded you that you guys really wanted to do, but you haven't been able to, like, you know, get it yet? What's on your wish list?
I can't really talk about that because we're in negotiations for some of them.
Oh, okay. But it's along the same lines of, you know, here's an idea. What station is the show on?
this sounds crazy, but I have a TiVo. I never know what station any show is on. It just pops up.
Yeah, because, I mean, just from knowing your games and your role-playing games you guys have going on, I mean, there's a lot of great shows out there. You know, there's the new Glade show on A&E. Then you have, of course, Law & Order and the CSI, the NCSIs. And things like that. So I guess I'm more curious to know, is it going to be more of a criminal? Is it going to be more like a Smallville supernatural, something like that, on the Charmed, I guess, side? You know, what kind of genres are you kind of looking at without saying?
Oh, yeah, I can't say.
Can't say that one either.
No,
okay.
No, I can't talk about
it. All right. But there are going to be some new ones that you're going to have coming out in the next, I guess, you know, couple years?
Yes,
is a year or so?
We are pursuing several different licenses.
Okay. And those are, I guess, pretty elusive to get on. So that's good, though. I mean, you know, you always got to stay out there and see what else we can come up. So
that's
great to look at. Because you, I mean, not just with your production company, but with your writing, I mean, you know, just to take 20 minutes out to talk to us, I mean, that's, you're constantly just busy.
Well, I don't know. My life is really pretty. I'm kind of semi-retired. I write in the morning and take my dogs for a walk, and I do flyball training and, you know, racing with my dogs. And
right.
So, yeah.
Well,
fun.
Well, I'll tell you, it's been great having you on here. I want everyone to go to MargaretWeiss.com to check out all the stuff that the production company is doing. You just heard that she's going to start having some of the books up. You got the Dragon Brigade series. You got the Dragon Ship series that's, you know, going on. Dragon Brigade comes out next year for the first book. So MargaretWeiss.com, because she's got leverage. They have Smallville, Supernatural, Serenity. And these are great games to sit down. A lot of people can have fun. I mean, you know, there's so many Facebook and everything else where people aren't getting together anymore, that this is a great way for people to actually get together and, you know, do things face-to-face instead of everything's always over the computer. So,
absolutely.
You know, so, but hey, Margaret, I appreciate it so much for you coming on. We're going to look for all of that, and thank you again.
Okay, thank you for inviting me so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
So we're going to hop right in here, and we're going to bring Chris Kuczynski on. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm wonderful. How about yourself?
Doing good. I'm just segueing right in here to your stuff, because you have a book that just came out, but your books are a little different, and I was reading your website where The Prophecy is your latest book that's here in the States.
That is correct.
And
yes.
But your other book, The Secret Crown, actually comes out in the UK as an American writer, comes out in the UK first before it hits the United States. And so kind of how does that happen, I guess, here? That's a little on the different side, don't you think?
Without a doubt it is. You know, originally when I first started out, Sign of the Cross, which was my second book, was the first book that I sold overseas, and it did so well in the British market that all of a sudden they decided that they wanted to try to rush and get my next book into print. So at that point in time, they were about 6 months behind the American publishing schedule. By the third book, which we call Sword of God, they pretty much caught up with the American publishing schedule. And then for the fourth book, they were rushing my books to print so fast, because my books are like top five bestsellers in the UK, that they ended up beating the pace of the Americans. So now I'm at the point where I literally finished writing this book less than a month ago, and they're releasing it next month in the UK. I mean, the turnaround time is unbelievable. So The Secret Crown will come out from Penguin UK in September, and then it won't come out here from Putnam in America until next summer.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, because that is a little bit different. So I guess we want to say, you know, The Prophecy is the book that's available here. It's going to be that's available now in the States now, and then your book, The Secret Crown, of course, will be available in the UK, and I think that was September. So we're going to – so The Prophecy, which you have now you know, you've gotten great reviews on all your books, and what I find fascinating is you're another author who has hundreds of rejection letters from agents, and you decided that you took a different approach, and you said, you know what, I have my book, I know it's good, and you started writing your favorite writers to see if they would review it, and you got some good answers back, didn't you?
Yeah, my first novel was called The Plantation, and I had written that, finished that up about 1999, so it's been over a decade now. And after going through that first stretch of query letters where I got rejected by not only every legitimate agent in the country, I mean, I was getting rejected by, like, agents that you have to pay to represent you. I mean, they were turning me out. I mean, it was that bad. I mean, my self-esteem was just, I mean, it was minuscule.
And your self-esteem was already probably a little on the downside because you played for the University of Pittsburgh, but we won't talk about that, so go ahead.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm a huge football fan, and I had to bring it up somehow, and you just kind of walked me into that one. I'm sorry.
You really did. Wow, I wasn't anticipating an ambush, you know, 4 minutes into the show, but man.
That was a good one, though. Okay, go ahead.
At that point, like most first-time authors, you know, I was extremely frustrated by the process. You know, I mean, publishers won't really talk to you unless you're represented, and if the agents won't touch you, then what is it that you can do? So, you know, I decided at that point that I was going to actually try to self-publish my book, simply because I was completely out of money. I had quit my – I had a teaching job and had given that up in order to pursue my dream of being a writer. And so out of sheer desperation, you know, I ended up doing a print-on-demand version of the Plantation. And, you know, I thought to myself, if anybody out there in the world would have empathy for a first-time writer, it would be other writers who maybe went through the same struggles that I was, you know, going through at that time. So, I had recently read a book by Lee Child and another one by Douglas Preston that I really enjoyed, and decided just on a whim that I was going to see if I could come up with their email addresses. And so we're talking 10 years ago, and so websites were just really starting to pop up, you know, for authors. And, you know, through one connection or another, I ended up getting their email addresses and wrote them a quick letter saying, you know, I really enjoyed your work. You know, would you, you know, take a chance reading, you know, my book? And surprisingly, they responded, like, almost immediately. I mean, within 24 hours, both of them had said, yeah, no problem at all. Send it to them.
Wow.
And then that
was kind of how you got going.
And that got it going, yeah. Once, you know, within a week, Lee Child had read the book and had loved it and gave just a glowing review for it. And Douglas Preston took a little bit longer. He was living in Italy at the time. You know, so I had to send it over to him in Italy, which, you know, he warned me. He's like, listen, Chris, he's like, you can send it to me, but if you send it via the post office, the mail is going to get stolen over here. You can't send anything regular mail. People steal stuff out of my mailbox all the time. He's like, you have to FedEx it to me internationally, or else I'm not going to get it. So I'm this starving artist, and I'm like scraping pennies together, you know, trying to pay the $50 to send it to him, you know, in Italy. But I'm like, you know, this
$50
is
10 years ago too. Now it's $150.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the case. But you know, at the time, it was like, my goodness, here's an author that, you know, he's on the New York Times bestseller list. You know, the book that I'd read was Relic, which I just absolutely loved, and it was like, hey, it's worth it. So I sent it to him, and you know, within 2 weeks for him, he wrote back to me, said he loved the book and would be happy to endorse it. And then from there, it just kind of went on and on. Before you knew it, I had everyone from James Patterson and Nelson DeMille and James Rollins, just to name a few, all endorsing this book. And at that point, it was still a self-published novel. I didn't have any agents or any mainstream publishers, you know, doing it.
Yeah, I mean, see, that, and there's a lot of authors now, and I think in today's day and age, because 10 years ago, you know, you didn't have the ability to do ebooks. There wasn't Amazon to do publishing and things like that. You had to do a lot of grassroots effort, literally without the help of what the internet can do now. So I think maybe that today's day and age, it would have been, if you would have started today, it might have been a little easier route for you to do. But that's a fascinating story. And now look at it. I mean, so I always like to ask authors, you know, what did you do to celebrate, you know, the publishing of your first book? But I guess your big thing is, you know, what did you do? You must have just been on cloud nine when Lee Child and Douglas Preston was like, yeah, I'll read it and I'll endorse it. I mean, I had just put you over the moon.
We're absolutely, without a doubt. You know, I think going up until that point, you know, I had friends and family who, even though they were very supportive, I still think there was some doubt in their mind. You know, it's like, geez, Chris, you just quit your teaching job in order to be a writer. I mean, can you really make a living doing that? And it wasn't until that point when I started getting some of those bigger name authors endorsing my books that people started saying, okay, maybe he's not just, you know, this might not be a pipe dream. This actually might be something that he can make a living doing. And, you know, it was, I can remember the moment that I really think that it was, you know, that I had that moment of elation was the day that that James Patterson, you know, responded to me and gave me an endorsement. At that time, he had like, you know, Patterson, he has like, you know, he had like 5 books in the top 10 at that time, you know, or something ridiculous.
Yeah.
He does a book every week, but you know, but at that time, I mean, that was, you know, it was kind of like, okay, you know, at that moment he had the number one book in the country, and he was saying, you know, not only Chris, do I love it, you know, he compared me to the early works of Stephen King in his endorsement, And I'm like, whoa, you know, this is, I mean, I don't write Stephen King type books, but just, you know, the mention of the name alone was just like, wow, this is, you know, this is going to help out. And ultimately it was those endorsements that ended up leading to me getting an agent and then ultimately, you know, a deal with Penguin.
Well, let's go here. I got a question from the chat room. So one of your fans is asking you, and this is kind of, and this is a good question, I think. So in your book, The Sword of God, you have an American soldier that is brutally executed. Have you ever gotten any, you know, negative fallout over that particular scenario that you wrote?
No. In fact, you know, Sword of God is one of those books that I was really anticipating that there might be some trouble. The basic premise of the story is that there's a group of Americans who are fed up with the terrorist acts that are occurring in American home soil. And this group of American soldiers decide that they're going to fight back by committing a terrorist act of their own in the city of Mecca. And you're talking about, you know, you're talking about the most holy city possible in Islam. And I was really expecting that there was going to be some major fall, you know, feedback from that was going to be hypercritical and so forth. But when I write my books, I always try to walk that line between, you know, the black and white. You know, I try to let people, you know, I don't try to make statements that are political or otherwise. I just, you know, I tell the story, I tell the actions. I have good characters and bad characters, and try to keep everything as balanced as possible. And believe it or not, at the end, whenever I started getting reviews from it, I actually started getting a lot of positive letters from the Muslim community saying, you know, this book could have just, you know, ripped our religion, and instead it actually highlighted a lot of the positive things in our religion, and, you know, we were very pleased with the outcome. And that stunned me. You know, I thought I was going to have to go into hiding, but, you know, it turned out that I was being praised. You
and Salman Rushdie are going to have to start running and finding a place to go.
Yeah, you know, I was just going to tell you, actually, when Douglas Preston was kind enough to endorse that book as well, and I was speaking to him at a Thriller Fest conference, right after he had read the book, he pulled me aside and he said, "Hey, Chris, I got a joke for you." He said, who's 6'2", blonde, and lives in South Beach? And I'm like, who? And he goes, Salman Rushdie. He's like, now remember that. That's how you go, you know, you have to go into hiding, you know, you're going to have to do the same sort of thing, you know. And I'm
right.
Like, funny. And then I started thinking about it. I'm like, oh, crap, is this what I'm going to have to do? Am I going to have to go into hiding?
Or do some kind of like a Shawshank and go to Zihuatanejo and, you know, go through Mexico on Fort Campbell, Texas, and just throw a postcard out to your, you know, family, and they'll be like, there he goes, he's gone.
you just never know. You know, you want to write the book that you want to write. You hope that it's positive feedback. You hope there's not death threats, even though, I mean, sometimes that actually helps sales.
True.
Yeah, in the case of that book, you know, I had very little negative feedback.
Well, kind of getting off of your suspense books here just for a second, because you knew this was going to come up, because you wrote a cookbook for monsters, okay? And so people want to know, what does a monster eat?
Well, you know, it depends on the type of monster. When I was a fourth grader, you know, the dream of being a writer has been in me for a very long time. And the first book I ever wrote was called The Monster Cookbook. And basically I created a series of creatures and then figured out what these creatures would actually eat, you know, their dietary needs and so forth. And I remember bringing this book in and showing my teacher, and my teacher absolutely loving it and showing it to the school's librarian, who loved it so much that she had the book hardbound and put in my school's library. And this was back in the day of card catalogs, and I remember being so proud that my name was like actually in the card catalog.
Oh my gosh, a card catalog. That's bringing back memories.
Yeah, that's scary. But yeah, I can remember that. And that was like, you know, that was at the kind of the moment where it was like, wow, this is what I want to do for a living. But the different creatures, you know, I mean, you know, depending on if we're talking about nocturnal creatures or they lived in the sea or whatever, I mean, they eat a wide variety of things. I went and contacted my school. This was probably about 10 years ago. Contacted them and asked them if they still had the book in the library, and it was no longer in there. So someday, if anyone ever sees that on eBay, I mean, that's like, you know, the number one first edition Chris Kozneski book. I mean, hop on that thing.
I'm going to go search eBay now. I wonder if any of everybody out there who's listening or is going to listen to the replay of this, if you have that book, you know, put it on, you have a very 100% first edition book right in your hands right now.
And you can know, and you'll know that it's the real thing if the illustrations were done in crayon, because I believe that's how I did them. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, we're talking fourth grade, you know, fourth grade art design, you know, it doesn't go beyond crayon, I don't think.
Oh, that's funny. So, I mean, so back here to The Prophecy, because that's the book that's available now in the U.S., and, you know, a lot of your books, because you are, you know, because you're a historical thriller. I mean, this one is about the writings of Nostradamus, which kind of come true. And your characters, Jonathan Payne and David Jones, are the ones that are in there. Now, if you had to choose a book and say, okay, I want you to start with this one to work your way up, should they start at the beginning? Or just jump right out there and get Prophecy right now, because that's the book that, you know, you're saying, okay, read this one first. If you've never read anything of me, I want you to read this one first.
Yeah, you know, I write my books as standalone thrillers that just happen to have the same main characters. You know, my stories are very much like, if you want to make a comparison to, like, say, a James Bond, where, you know, you can watch any James Bond movie in any order.
And he's my favorite, by the way. He's my favorite.
Yeah, well, you know, but it's, you know, my guys are very self-contained. These stories are self-contained. So you could very easily start with a prophecy. Whenever people ask me that question, I always tell them, you know, is there a particular part of history do you like? I mean, if you like ancient Greece, then you want to start with the Lost Throne. If you're interested in Nostradamus, then definitely the prophecy. If it's Christianity or the Catholic faith, then Sign of the Cross, which was my second book. You know, and Sword of God, as I mentioned, has to do with Islam and the Middle East. So a lot of times I'll just ask them, what is it that you want to read about? And then I've got characters that travel to that part of the world and explore that part of history.
And as you are a historical writer, how much I would have to say that probably historical writing is the one genre off of suspense and thriller that has to be researched the most. Because you got to get your facts correct, and so how much time do you go and put into researching?
Quite a bit. You know, my books are historical, you know, historical based, but they're all modern day stories. You know, sometimes when people, they think that I'm writing my characters are taking place, you know, it's back in the 1700s or something.
Right.
And that's not the case. But, you know, first of all, what I try to do is, you know, when I come up with the basic plot of my story and I'm thinking of the basic storyline, you know, with the Nostradamus, I got many books from the library, did as much internet research as I could, tried to learn as much as you possibly can about Nostradamus. So you have basically, you know, a stack of ammo that you can use when you're writing. You know, you have all these tidbits and facts that you can throw in, and you kind of know that they're at your disposal anytime you want to use them. And then once I start my story, you know, I'll find my characters are all of a sudden in Switzerland, or my characters are in the UK, or wherever the case might be. And then I'll have to do research on that particular day in order to make that particular scene authentic. I'm not the type of writer that plots my books ahead of time. I basically have a very, very, very general concept of the story. And then my books just kind of take a life of their own. So, you know, I'm not sure what's going to happen 100 pages from now. So when I reach that point, you know, I might have to research and see, you know, what are the streets in Paris like? You know, what buildings are located in this part of the city in order to make that scene, you know, realistic.
Yeah, and I was just going to kind of you kind of answered the next question I was going to kind of ask. So I'm going to go a little bit forward and say,
I did a lot of research on Nostradamus, so I can see the future. So I knew what you were going to ask, and that's why I jumped ahead for you.
You did. That was good. But, you know, if you would have known that before, you probably would have picked a different college besides Pittsburgh to go play football for. But that's okay, too.
Yeah, you know, I mean, hey, we're a bowl team. We're in the top 20, you know.
That's true. It only took you 20 years after Marino to get there, but you did. I will admit that, you know, you did, which is good.
We were a top 20 team, and if I can't, if I couldn't damage the team that much, you know, then, I mean, we can survive anything. I mean, come on.
Hey, and I might have, and the funny thing is, I might have actually seen you play, because I actually went to a couple of University of Pittsburgh's games when I saw them play Rutgers, and my dad graduated from Rutgers. We always went to one game a year, and every other year we'd end up going to Pittsburgh because I lived in Columbus, Ohio. So I might have seen you actually play, and that stadium was very scary. Now they play at Heinz Field, which is much nicer.
If you saw me play, then you were really drunk, because I never got in the games. So, you know, I mean, you know, obviously, but, you know, against Rutgers, I guess we played the scrubs all the time anyway, because we were always.
Yeah, you played. It was like 59-0. You were in the game. Okay. You were there. They weren't very good, but they're good now. So that's good.
Good.
Now, so the Secret Crown comes out September 30th, like we said, in the UK. And then it's going to come out in the United States. But when exactly is that book coming out in the United States?
Right now it's slotted for a July release. I don't have an exact release date yet. It's a little too early for them to give me the date. But you know, my last few hardbacks from Putnam have come out in July, so that's what they're anticipating. You know, so they generally, you know, a couple weeks before the hardcover comes out, they'll do the paperback of the prophecy. Through Berkeley, and then the new hardcover will come out a couple weeks after that. So
okay. So now, since we already know, you know, that the Secret Crown is finished, and I'm sure that you're already working on something else, where is history taking us into your next book?
You know, that's a very good question. You know, the fact remains that, you know, I've reached a point now where I'm actually thinking of doing a couple books a year. Instead of doing, you know, all Payne and Jones, I've really been toying around with the idea of starting another series. And
outside of historical fiction?
The books would have you know, once again, modern day thrillers, but we're still kind of tweaking some of the details as far as, you know, what avenue it would be. I mean, it would definitely, I'd love writing international type stories. You know, so no matter what, we're going to have the opportunity for international travel, because, you know, I want to go on vacation to these places and use them as tax write-offs, you know, so that's basically, I mean, that's one of the good things about being a writer. You can go anywhere and write it off, say it's research. I'm definitely going to stay in the thriller genre. It's just, you know, exactly whether it'll be historical based or whether it'll be more spy based or what the case may be. That's where we're still kind of, working on that. But so right now my focus is actually on trying to figure out this new universe that I'm going to create. And then, you know, the next Payne and Jones book, I have until, well, next June to finish it. So I got plenty of time to get that thing done.
And just to remind everybody, we've been talking here for the past 20-so minutes with Chris Kuznetsky and about his book that's out in the United States called The Prophecy, and he just mentioned that The Secret Crown is coming out in the UK on September 30th and will be available in the United States sometime in 2011. And so now I'm kind of wondering, when you're sitting there talking about, you know, your new series, and you said we. Now, when you say we, is that you and your editor that are sitting down talking about it, or you have somebody else in your back pocket?
Normally what I try to do whenever I do have a couple of writer friends that I definitely, you know, talk to and use them as sounding boards. You know, a lot of times the discussion also goes on with my agent. You know, ultimately, I want to do something creatively that I enjoy. But at the same time, you know, writing is still a business, so I want to make sure that whatever I come up with, there's a market for it. So so whenever you're doing a book proposal for a new series, you know, the person that eventually is going to sell it is my agent, Scott Miller. And so I have a lot of close contact with both Scott, and then since my books do so well internationally, then it's also talking to my foreign agents also and trying to get a feel, you know, whether or not you know, sticking to this same type of genre, the historical fiction genre, is the way to go, or if there's, you know, some other market out there that maybe there's an opening in. So, you know, and even though creatively you're thinking as a writer, you also have to be a businessman in some way. You have to, you know, you don't want to write particularly for a particular market. I mean, because markets shift all the time. But, you know, you also want to have the feedback for the people that are ultimately going to be selling your book. So so we kind of – Scott jokingly calls himself Team Miller. You know, so actually I think we jokingly called it that at Thriller Fest, and he just agreed to go with it.
Which we were there, and I think that we missed seeing you.
Well, you know, I tend to avoid anybody that's wearing Rutgers colors or anything like that. So.
Oh, that was cold. And I didn't even have my Rutgers colors on. And you were right there in New York, so you better have been quiet about the whole Pittsburgh thing because that's where they are. So, you know.
I'll tell you what. Rutgers is a Big East brethren. You know, so I'm very pro Big East when it comes to all sports. And so, you know, I joke, but, you know, if they're not playing Pitt, I root for them. So that's the way I always am. So
the good thing, and you know, but you're not going to, I'm looking here and I'm looking at your tour, which it looks like just ended on July the 20th. It wasn't that long. You didn't do that long of a tour. I don't know if that's something that you might be doing longer in the future, but I also see that New Brunswick or Piscataway was not on your tour. Is that something that you're going to do more in the future? Are you going to try to do more tours and more signings out of bookstores? Because you did go to a lot of places. I mean, you went from Florida to Minnesota to Texas to Arizona. So you were kind of all over.
Yeah, the Putnam, who's my hardcover publisher, you know, they have a very good formula when it comes to promoting their authors. You know, Putnam has more New York Times bestsellers than any other publishing house. And their philosophy is whenever they first have an author in hardcover, they'll first take them out with a regional tour, kind of get their feet wet, help them, you know, understand, you know, the ins and outs of touring, meeting fans, doing signings, and then they slowly but surely build up your national following. So this book was more of a national tour where, like you mentioned, you know, I did a number of events in some key stores around the country. You know, the Poison Pen in Scottsdale and Murder by the Book and Once Upon a Crime and some of the hallowed names in the bookselling market in America. And so then for the next book, you know, the goal would be to broaden it even further, you know, whether it's out to the West Coast or whether it's doing the Northeast. You know, there's been a big push recently. I have, as I mentioned, the fan support I get in the UK is phenomenal. And there's like a letter writing campaign going on right now for my UK fans to try to get me touring over there. You know, so if my British editor is listening, please, you know, bring me over.
Let's get Chris across the pond. He needs to go over there.
Without a doubt. You know, so yeah, the goal is definitely to go to other places. And, you know, I've also had a number of sales in the secondary markets, you know, whether it's Italy or Spain or whatever. So, you know, I'm always down for a European tour. I wouldn't have a problem with that at all.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm looking at the time, and it has just flown by, Chris, and I want to thank you so much for coming on. I want everyone to go to chriskuznewski.com, and that's Chris, and his last name is spelled KUZNESKI.com. Great website. Find out a lot of information about, you know, where he's going to be at, what books are going on, great excerpts you can read from the book. So, Chris, I want to thank you so much for coming on. And, you know, we'll stay in touch in the future and have you back, you know, when, you know, The Secret Crown hits the U.S. in the summer.
That would be wonderful. I'd love to come back, John. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And you have a great night.
Okay.
So, everybody, I want to say thank you again to our guests, Margaret Weiss and Chris Guneski, here for coming on and speaking with us tonight. Don't forget that on Tuesday night, Suspense Radio is going to be back. And we are going to have a little bit different here. We're going to have Megan Batty on, who's a publicist, and she's the publicist, actually, of Chris Farnsworth, who wrote The Bud Oath, and they're going to be our guests here on Tuesday night. So you're going to get a little bit of insight, not only from the author, but from a publicist's point of view on exactly what they have to do to get their authors out there. So make sure you check us out, suspensemagazine.com. You can click on Suspense Radio, and, you know, it's going to be a great time. I want everyone to get out. I want everyone to enjoy themselves. after here Friday night. I want you to have a great weekend. I'm going to be a little cliche because thank you for joining us. See you on Tuesday night.